Welcome to First Reading, the Old Testament lectionary podcast for preachers, teachers, and curious readers of the Hebrew Bible everywhere. I'm Rosie Candleful. I teach the Bible at Wake Forest University in North Carolina.
And I'm Tim McMinch. I teach at Christian Theological Seminary, and I'm one of those curious Bible readers. So. And here we are, folks, with an episode for the second Sunday after Epiphany, which falls on January 19th this year. The first reading is Isaiah 62, verses 1 through 5. I feel like we were just in Isaiah.
We're in Isaiah a lot, aren't we?
All right. So where are we at here, Rosie? Isaiah 62, that sounds like, what, third Isaiah?
Yeah, that's where we are, right? So just last week, Tim, you had the episode. We were looking at second Isaiah. So let's give folks a little bit on historical and literary context here when we talk about third Isaiah, right? Who is this fellow, this community? What are we talking about when we talk about Trito Isaiah? When we talk about third Isaiah, we're looking really at a few chapters in the great giant book of Isaiah. So 24 to 27 and 56 to 66 are where we think we hear the voice of third Isaiah, who is speaking from Jerusalem and addressing Israel after the return from the exile in Babylon, which had begun probably around 537 BC. We're looking at kind of a later part of the 6th century. Mm-hmm. And what we are getting when we listen to 3rd Isaiah very basically is kind of a response in some ways to the hope that 2nd Isaiah was preaching. And here, when we get to the actual work of rebuilding, what we are encountering are some of the difficulties and challenges of rebuilding and restoration. So when we hear 3rd Isaiah, we often encounter some of the kind of pessimism that's setting in for those that have returned and have found their work much more difficult than what they might have hoped. And that often is the case with, the reality of rebuilding a life. One that had, as we have talked on this podcast over and over again, had been destroyed during the exile in ways that just shattered the life community, the buildings, religious structures, economic structures, social structures. So when we encounter 3rd Isaiah, we are thinking about that historical context. And what we're getting is maybe an older and disillusioned 2nd Isaiah, in dialogue with those oracles, right? So we're hearing an older voice here. But when we get to 62, our lectionary kind of gives us a cut, and it's, a really lovely celebration poem that is taking up the theme of restoration, but it's in the middle of a whole section of oracles that are also speaking to some of the difficulties here. So just something to be aware of as we think about the context of Isaiah 62, our passage, our first reading for today. It begins with, "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until her vindication shines out like the dawn and her salvation like a burning torch," right? So here we hear the voice, the I again. So Tim, last week you were also speaking about the I voice. Here is the Lord speaking up and saying, "I will not keep silent. I will not rest until her vindication shines out like the dawn," right? And so our NRSV, that word vindication sounds old-fashioned. And in the Hebrew, it's tzedakah, right? So righteousness, that word that often appears in our Hebrew text, right? And it's repeated again in verse 2. "The nation shall see your vindication," your tzedakah, your righteousness, right? So one of the things I might kind of just bring up for our listeners is that repetition of that word, as preachers maybe think about, and it certainly made me think a moment about what that might mean. What is it that the poet wants us to see, like the light of the dawn, like a burning torch? So, again, "Let all the kings see your glory, your kavod," right? That is a word that's often associated with God, right? So, again, this kind of connection between glory, righteousness, right? The poem continues, "You shall be called by a new name, a Shem Kadesh, no longer forsaken, no longer desolate, but a delight." So the names are no longer Azubah or Shemama, but delight, right? Hepzibah, Beulah, married, right? So one of the reasons why we're getting this text, right, is if you skipped into the gospel reading, We're seeing the wedding of Cana, John chapter 2, the first sign of Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the lectionary is making a pretty direct maybe connection between those two, marriage metaphor and the actual marriage that that you celebrate with his friends there.
I feel like you have something you want to say about this marriage stuff. Before we get to that, though, can we jump back for a moment to vindication? You hit on that. And you said, what is it that we want to shine out like the dawn? Can you say a little bit more about that? What are you doing with that word, Zedek?
Yeah. I'm glad you asked that, because I would love to work this out with you a little bit more, right? So I myself am a bit unsure how we define righteousness, right? And it has this kind of old-fashioned King James Version kind of word that we don't use in our modern parlance, you know? And so I think it might be worth maybe the two of us kind of thinking a little bit about how we see this word in the Hebrew Bible, why it's highlighted here as we think about what Third Isaiah is trying to say. What is your glory, O Israel? What is it that you should be shining forth? What is so attractive about the message that you have to offer? And I think it might be worth thinking about here in, you know, the January, we're in the middle of January here. Our New Year's resolutions have maybe, I don't know if our energy is still there to follow through on those resolutions, but whatever it is, maybe we want to think about what is a right action for this year? You know, what does it mean to have our righteousness shine out like the dawn? Let it be a burning torch. What do our communities want to be known for as we think about this new year? I'd welcome your thoughts, Tim, on...
Yeah, I agree with you. Righteousness is a kind of old-fashioned-y word. I mean, it's translated in the NRSV as vindication, which is another, I don't know, highfalutin sort of word. Even though the Hebrew word tzedek is quite basic, and it just has to do with rightness. I mean, righteousness has the word right in it, so it kind of helps with that. But I usually see it as a kind of relational word. So rightness as in an appropriate relational mode. Rightness as like doing right by someone. So it has connotations of like faithfulness and
justice.
All of that kind of gets wrapped up in it as well. So here in the poem, we have it in parallel with salvation in verse 1, and then in parallel with glory in verse 2. So it seems to me like it may be less about, wow, there's such a moral people who have just such pure lives. And it may be more about, look at how closely they're in relationship with God. And that rightness of their relationship is something that shines out and is glorious for the world to see. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that's really helpful as I think about how to handle the marriage metaphor as it continues in that poem, right? So I think what you're helping me see is that frame actually makes me think about what a right relationship with God might look like, right? So the marriage metaphor is meant to maybe create some concreteness around that, the loyalty of a spousal relationship, right? You shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord, a royal diadem in the palm of your God, right? So something there about, you know, how beautiful it is to be in that kind of relationship with God. And then it goes on to say, the Lord delights in you. Your land shall be married, for as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your builder marry you. As the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you, right? So I had in my initial reading of this kind of a little bit of a, you know, pitfall for preachers. Oh, no, here we go. You know, we kind of have a very strong heteronormative kind of, you know, male over female, patriarchal, hierarchical, all of that, you know, is kind of larded in with ancient marriage as a metaphor. Yeah. And it's one that we have seen the prophets use to justify the kind of abusive relationship that they've committed adultery and that they have kind of strayed from their marriage vows, and that has been why the exile has happened in some ways. And here, Third Isaiah is kind of bringing back that metaphor, but here in more positive sense, in that, you know, God will no longer abandon you, will no longer forsake you for your errors or your straying. but instead, you know, restoration to our youth in some way. So I'll just go ahead and say that that might be a pitfall for preachers as they think about the single people in their congregation. So, you know, marriage by and in and of itself is a wonderful thing and also can be a problematic thing to kind of glorify without more muscle. But mm-hmm. maybe the frame that you're offering, Tim, or just kind of maybe helping me think through is this idea of a right relationship, right? What does that look like? And here is the prophet trying to think through a right relationship, mm-hmm. a return to faithfulness, to covenantal faithfulness, to a you know, kind of special loyalty, a particular love and attention, you know, the kind of focus that you have with a new relationship. It's unlike maybe anything mm-hmm. else. That kind of, you know, I am so attentive to, you know, to everything you say, everything you do, in ways that maybe even an old married couple, you know, you can become used to one another. But here, what we have is a glorification of young love, like, you know, kind of first mm-hmm. love. So anyway, those are, you know, maybe some of the thoughts that I'm spinning out with you on righteousness and right relationship.
Yeah, I think that's great, Rosie. It makes me think a lot about, I've been working with my students recently on just what is it that we're doing when we're doing biblical exegesis? Mm. And what, especially around metaphorical language, what carries through over time into our own context and what is so embedded in its own cultural context that we have to kind of translate the metaphor itself in order for it to be useful exegetically in our own context. And I think you're hitting on some ways that this marriage metaphor has some limitations. Because in the mind of the author of this text, it's you know, making a whole, spinning out a whole metaphorical world in relation to a very culturally particular practice of marriage, and our own experiences of marriage and relationships in our modern context are quite different from what those relationships were like in the ancient world. And so we have to do some of the work that you've been modeling for us in finding unpacking the metaphor in its ancient context and then bringing that through to the modern context. So in this case, it's not so much about a heteronormative, cisgendered relationship between a man and a woman, but, you know, in the ancient world, marriages were a kind of social partnership. Mm-hmm. And the best marriages, you know, the partners of the marriage worked together so that the household functioned really well. So a righteous marriage, one that would be marked by tzedek, would be one that just functions well to the blessing of the whole extended family and their place in the community. Mm-hmm. And that part of the metaphor, maybe we can carry over into some of, you know, unpacking this metaphor around letting our right relationship with God shine as good partners with what God is doing in us and in the world, that in itself is attractive for the world to see. So I think there's some way of working with the metaphor rather than just reading against it and sort of rejecting it because it's kind of lost to history and cultural embeddedness. We can still bring forward some aspects of it into our own world like that. And I think you've been doing that well here.
I think you're also helping me look at the gospel passage too, right? So the wedding of Cana, I think maybe helps illustrate some of what you're saying is that here is Jesus, a celibate, well, as far as we know, celibate man, unmarried, certainly, celebrating a wedding in a community of friends, a social community, and contributing, you know, so he, mm-hmm. this is first sign for John of Jesus's vocation in the world. And it is the provision, changing of water into wine as wine runs out at this wedding, right? And so what we see is a celebration there of, you know, of marriage, maybe a right action in the midst, right? But I think, mm-hmm. Tim, even before we began this episode, I had a question too about, like, you know, some of us might have some questions about what the right action would have been to do, right? As the wine runs out, Jesus decides to step in and act, you know, even though when his mom informs him of the situation, he says, "Woman, what does that have to do with you and me?" Yeah. And yet, Jesus contributes here, doing something kind, doing something generous, seeing a need and meeting it. I don't know. Maybe there's something here for preachers to think about as we think about, you know, how to look at the world and how to contribute to loving, just relationships. How do we make that shine out like the dawn? Like that being the first sign of Jesus is a real challenge to me. That this would be how John frames who Jesus is. Someone who acts to provide wine, a luxury, you know, something to delight in, sort of the language that we see in Isaiah 62, my delight is in you.
Yeah.
And in some way, Jesus is also showing the ability to delight in a union and a community coming together.
Yeah, don't we need some of that delight these days? I mean, it's so easy to focus on everything that's going wrong. And I think the wedding scene in John is a great example of Jesus finding, you know, the whole gospel is Jesus coming into a broken, messed up situation with God's salvation. But here, this is like a little glimmer of goodness in a broken world. It's a wedding. It's the making of a family and relationship, and Jesus takes that good thing and makes it better. Lets the party be a real party, you know?
Yeah.
And so maybe there's some indication there that where we do see rightness, righteousness, tzedek, good things, it's worth, even in the midst of broken times, to celebrate those things and to let them actually have their moment, have them shine out as glimmers of God's goodness, even in a pretty messed up scenario.
I love that for January 19th, you know, and also just because like it's the second Sunday of Epiphany, and Epiphany is translated just the revelation of God, the appearance of God. Mm-hmm. And the appearance of God is joy, right? So there is just a mutual recognition in that maybe on the second Sunday of Epiphany, that for preachers to maybe think about how do we make God apparent? How do we reveal God in our joy, in what we take joy in, and the kinds of right relationships that we're developing in our midst? And that's a prayer I hold for myself and for, you know, my communities.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a great place to wrap things up for this week with a kind of hopeful, joyful note.
Not always here we end, but yeah.
Thanks for all you work on that, Rosie.
Sure, my pleasure.
Well, folks, thanks so much for tuning in to First Reading this week. If you'd like to learn more about our podcast or see our back episodes, you can find them on our website, firstreadingpodcast.com. You can also find us on YouTube and wherever you get your audio podcasts as well. If you'd like to drop us a line, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at firstreadingpodcast@gmail.com. Or just send us some feedback via the places where you get your podcasts, a review or a note. We'd love to hear from you. Well, until next time, I'm Tim McNinch.
And I'm Rosie Candlethal. Happy preaching.